My name is Barry Essen. I work for a company called Arica. We're organising this tour. Thank you very much for coming along. I've got some things that I wanted to, or I have to say, or that I'd like to say. This tour, this project is called Shadowed Spaces, and it's kind of about our need, or a societal need. There are places in our towns and cities that have an elusive quality that maybe you and I don't see every day, but if certain people have a certain need to find them, then they do find them. Maybe it offers them some kind of like sense of privacy in public, and I think we've all got certain things that we do now and again that we don't want to share with everybody. And I think there's a nice analogy between that sense of privacy in public and a musician's performance, in the sense that it's a very private thing that's done publicly, or a personal thing that's done publicly. Hopefully this little jaunt tonight will take you to some parts of the city that you maybe don't know about, or that you haven't seen, or you haven't been there since you were a kid taking illegal substances. I'm not sure. But hopefully the idea is that it gets you to look at your surroundings in a different way. We're going to go to three different sites tonight. They're all a very short walk from here. The length of the performance or the event will be round about 90 minutes, which is much less, you know, that's less than a standard Hollywood movie these days, so I hope you don't get bored during the duration of it. The sites are a bit kind of scummy, so do watch your feet for standing on nails or in some cases human excrement. What else do I have to say? It's possible that it might rain. We've got some brawlies for you over there. If you want to take one, please do. Bryony, what else have I got to say? Thanks very much to the Arts Council for giving us the money to do this, and particularly in Dundee, DCA, who've helped us greatly with this project as well. We also do our project with them called Kill Your Timid Notion that some of you might have come to. I always forget what else I have to say. Bryony, can you think of anything? Okay, all right. Well, then I hope you have a good night, and why don't we all walk around this way?
My name is Dennis Wood, and I don't know who I am. That's how I began a paper once, when I was feeling conflicted between my identity as a steelworker and my identity as an economist. Which is a point I raise, because if I were to say, "Hi, my name is Dennis Wood, I'm a second biographer," I would have, in a way, precisely the same kind of conflict. That is to say, whether I'm a kind of psychogeographer I used to imagine I was when I was a graduate student in geography, or whether I'm the kind of psychogeographer I'm increasingly being associated with, which is the kind of psychogeography, the situations the lecturists invented in the late 50s. They're very different. They have very different kinds of trajectories, and I come to that in a very different kinds of ways. I certainly come by my title, psychogeographer, legitimately, from an academic perspective. As I say, as a graduate student, I was a student of geography, but I wrote both my master's thesis and my doctoral dissertation under the supervision of two psychologists, David Stay and Robert J. Beck. The first of whom, I wrote a book called A Cognitive Atlas, Explorations into the Psychological Geography of Four Mexican Cities. Latter from my wrote a book called Rules. Psychogeography at Clark was the product of the fact that Clark University had a very strong psychology department and a very strong geography department. And in 1967, in an effort to bring these two together in some way, they created a joint position, and geography essentially hired a psychologist who started teaching a diverse bunch of subjects
eventually became known as psychogeography among the geographers, and as environmental psychology among the psychologists. We were very interested in the interface between human behavior and the environment, and both of those very, very broadly construed. Certainly, I think in the beginning, a lot of attention was focused on an idea that we called mental maps. We had this idea that people had maps in their heads in some way, and they used these maps to organize their relationship with the macro environment. Psychogeography had, I think, a pretty good run of 5 or 6 years. It really didn't last long as an academic moment. And it transforming itself pretty generally into something called environmental psychology, which is pretty broadly taught on psychology campuses today, but which had its origin in this nexus of activities. It wasn't as a psychogeographer, however, that I got involved in the shadowed spaces. I was doing some really simple, straightforward geography. A colleague of mine, a cartographer named George McCleary, and I were teaching a course on urban water. And in the course of that course, we took all of our students to every bit of urban water in the city of Worcester, Massachusetts. And most of these were fenced, either to save the water from the people or to save the people from the water. So we were constantly climbing over fences or climbing under fences and investigating spaces that weren't supposed to have any people in it. And wherever we went, we found signs of human habitation and occupation and utilization, such as you see all around you here. That is to say, not the walls and the building, which are clearly such signs, but the broken bottles, the smashed cans, the bags, the cast-off clothing, and so forth. What were these doing in these spaces that were closed to people? Now, you know, in a way, I look back on this and I'm like, how naive could I be? It's not like I was discovering these things for the first time. Certainly, growing up, I had found the shadowed spaces and I had used the shadowed spaces and I'd even celebrated the shadowed spaces. It's pretty hard to live in any kind of world that we live in without making use of these spaces on a fairly regular basis. So it was with a different sense of realizing that there was a system in these places and they had certain kinds of characteristics in common. They weren't random moments in your life, that there was a whole other city, as it were, or a whole other country, as it were, that was shadowed and that was utilized in increasingly, obviously, different kinds of ways. I didn't really begin to theorize this, however, until, having talked about these spaces again and again and again, I was invited to give a paper at a criminological conference in Stockholm in 1978. And it was in the doing of that I began to theorize how these spaces might work and what these spaces might be. And I did so, now drawing on my sort of psychogeography, with a framework of deviance. The criminology emphasis sort of forced this attention on me. And what were the shadow spaces? They were spaces where deviant behavior took place. Now, I have a terrific problem with the idea of deviance, also because I have a terrific problem with the idea of normalcy or normal. And it became clear to me that I could get rid of these ideas pretty easily by thinking about behavior solely in terms of the temporal spatial requirements that had to be met for them to take place. And it became pretty clear as you, and this doesn't take a lot of hard thinking, that there are some activities you engage in that you don't want to engage in or share with anybody else. There are things you do by yourself that you wouldn't do if other people were around. And then there are other kinds of things you do in small groups. You might do with a spouse, or you might do with a sibling, or a parent, or a child, or you might do with your friends, and other kinds of associates. And those aren't necessarily going to be shared. That is to say that just because you're not a small number doesn't mean you're going to do the same behaviors in the same spaces with the same group of people. And then there are increasingly public kinds of activities, things that you do and are willing to do in the presence of others, and there are a bunch of things you probably pretty much exclusively do in the presence of others, public kinds of things, really public kinds of things. So it became pretty clear I could get rid of the idea of deviance, and I could get rid of the idea of normal entirely if I just started thinking of behavior in terms of those kinds of spatiotemporal requirements. And I elaborated this in a paper called In Defense of Indefensible Space, which is published and is available in a volume on environmental chronology. And it's pretty formal. And what it looks at are the screens that are required to be interposed between you and the normative eye. This normative eye is an interesting thing as well. The normative eye, I have never seen so many normative eyes in my life as I have since I've been in Scotland, although I understand that even more in London. But these CCTV cameras that are everywhere knock me out. I mean, there's no place you can go without seeing one of these things. In fact, often enough with a sign that tells you that you are being watched, and you're being watched for your own good. That's the normative eye embodied in a peculiarly crystalline kind of way. But clearly this idea of what constitutes normal behavior is something we also internalize and carry around this like normative eye inside our head. I didn't really like Peter Jackson's versions of the Tolkien movies, of the Tolkien books, but one of the things I did like that he did was when he took Sauron's eye and just made that giant eye standing on the top of the tower, because it really struck me that that is the normative eye, and it just watches us, because since we carry it around inside our own head, it's with us all the time, and it is what ultimately determines what kind of place and what kind of time we need in order to do whatever it is we might be doing. One of the great things this does is it disobligates us from thinking about deviant and normal compared to who, compared to what. There isn't any compared to anything, since it's all going to be ultimately interpreted through your own version of that normative eye. It's really what you think has to be done in private, or what you think has to be done in public. These kinds of behaviors run an enormous gamut. And they create or co-create various kinds of spaces. Two nights ago in Aberdeen, we performed in a space whose legitimacy as a shadowed space I wasn't altogether convinced of. It didn't have enough detritus. There weren't any needles, there weren't any cast-off clothing. It lacked all the broken bottles and broken glass. Of course, it turned out that the console came down and cleaned it up before we performed. But it had all those things when we first saw it, and I guess, well, if you're going to perform music in public, you can't have those kinds of signs around. And it made it really clear how fragile these spaces are. They really don't want any kind of attention. They don't really want any kind of point. And this also focuses attention on why I was thinking about them as in defense of indefensible space. I don't know. Actually, I guess the CCTVs are part of this. But in the late 60s, a movement began to make spaces defensible. There was a perception at the time, which I'm sure we feel today, maybe even more intensely, I don't know. I never really thought of myself, and that is a complete terror that the barbarians are loose amongst us and we're going to be wiped out by the criminals and the cons and so forth. We have to constantly vigilant, constantly protecting ourselves. And in order to do this, what you do is you make spaces bright, you put public lights up every place, you lit up the trees. In fact, there's a little traffic island as you come across into the space over there. And if you poke your head in that traffic island, you'll see under those bushes exactly what you expect to see under those bushes. That's in there, cast off wine bottles, and there's cast off newspapers and cigarette packs. The spaces are clearly used, but you can't do that when the limbs are all limbed up and the space is open and everybody can see everything and everything's totally intervisible. Foucault's panopticon, Foucault's vision of the surveillance society, is exactly what Oscar Newman, in particular, who wrote this book on defensible space, was trying to promote. And it certainly caught on. I mean, it certainly caught on really big with the police departments and with a lot of other public agencies. And I think we see the consequences of the world around us today. My feeling, however, is that the behaviors that take place in these spaces indicate nights, and people are going to perform these activities, and they'll need spaces in which to perform them, or they're going to wither and die as a people. And, you know, when I think about these spaces, I don't want to focus attention solely on deviant sexual behavior and drug use and so forth and so on. I'm also talking about all of the underground activities that take place that we turn around and celebrate X number of years later once the movements that they've set in motion have become, you know, standard fare. And you can think about early Dada behavior. You can think about the Situationists. You can think, of course, about almost any revolutionary activity. The cells and seeds of which are all planted in the darkness where, in fact, because they're opposed to authority in the most violent kind of way, have to take place out of the sight of anybody else. The things that really, when we celebrate in the case of the United States, these are all our first presidents in revolutionary warrior ways. All of these people were engaged in violent and deviant behavior with respect to the British Crown. So I'm not just talking about a narrow gamut of behavior, I'm talking about an absolutely enormous gamut of behaviors. All of these behaviors call for certain kinds of spaces, and they shape those spaces. This is a marginal example of a shadow space right here. It's really kind of open. I think under the building here is a lot more interesting as a shadowed space than right out here. And clearly that little niche back there, which is filled with somebody smashed a computer and there's a broken bicycle back there. I don't know what those things are doing there. Right? Someone's just trying to get rid of trash. Or they were stolen goods and they're just being off there. And who can tell exactly what they are? Those strike me as more in keeping with the core idea of the shadow space. But certainly this is a marginal space. This is not a space where decent people are going to be. And in fact, one of the things I think these performances really ask is about the music that's being played in them. What is it about these spaces that calls this music into being in them? I hope this doesn't happen tonight, but two nights ago in Dundee, we had a heckler shouting at Tonya, who's playing the saxophone, and we had a potato thrown at us, we had an onion thrown at us. You know, sort of the stigmata of the fact that really there is something about the performances that really wants to take place in a shadow space. I think the shadow spaces have to be preserved if we're going to have any kind of human society. And I feel they're very much under assault. The real problem here is that you can't defend them in a kind of clear, articulated way. Because as soon as you do that, you draw attention to them. And in drawing attention to them, you allow them to live. You can't fence it off and say, that's a shadowed space. That's not how they work. And that's not how they come into being. And that's not how they maintain themselves. So, having said these things, I guess we can now go on to the next venue.
Yeah, you certainly can. Why don't we head in that general direction? We've got some up here.
Yeah.
Lead them over to the next space.
Yeah.
What do you think of that?
Thank you.
Dolly Parton story.
I'll be there. Riverside, notorious dogging area. That's how I met Jenny. I can smoke in my flat when I was in third year and I had my car, so I just like take it out and just go for a fag. And I sat down there and I was on the phone to my cousin smoking away. And all these cars were like, driving past me, like slowing down, looking in my window, and I'm like, ah, get away. When did you go to Poland?
I've never been to Poland
when?
In my life.
When? No, Iceland. Sorry, Iceland.
Tuesday.
Are you excited?
Yeah, I really am.
That's good. This is to the homeless shelter. Ah, it's just for long. Oh. Let's go.
Yeah, I'd like to see it.
I'd like to see it too.
suggestions? No? Really? Seriously? Okay, well then, thanks very much for coming along.
Fine.
Thank you.
We're really interested in places in like the towns and cities where you can kind of go and do something that's kind of secretive. Like when I was growing up, I used to go and have a fag for your parents and go to the city, or we would go and kind of drink when I was underage. So we're really interested in those kinds of places.
How did you make out?
Yeah, it was good.
Good.
It was good. Stop.
Too distracting for you?
No, no. Stop.